Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 18, delivered on April 3, 2019. The title of this lecture is Stock Valuation.
Today, stock valuation. To start this out, I will finish the capital asset pricing model, which is actually a very simple thing. It has been around for a long, long time, over 50 years, and there have been challengers who say there are better ways to find the required rate of return on a stock. Now, I want to make a point here. In order to do a lot of things in finance, you have to have an interest rate to discount future cash flows and all of that. But there are a couple of different ones that are used from time to time. There's one which is we designate, and I'm going to put it as a K. I think the book actually uses K for this. This is the required rate of return. This is what you must make based upon the risk of the project. If it's a low-risk project, that might be 4%. If it's a high-risk project, that might be 16%. But this is the required rate of return in order to say yes to a project. If a project is going to deliver you 12%, but you can find less risky projects that are delivering 14%, you're going to say no to that project. Then there's another one, and I'll talk about this later in the course, and things get pretty ugly when I explain this one in detail. The weighted average cost of capital. That's essentially, just as it says, you're going to get capital from stock, you're going to get capital from the money that you make at the end, at the bottom line, you're going to get money from debt, that you, money that you borrow. The weighted average cost of capital is just essentially the average of those methods for getting money. You most definitely, the weighted average cost of capital, if the weighted average cost of capital for a company is right now 8%, and a project can make 6%, I'm going to say, no, I can't even make what it costs me for it. But if my weighted average cost of capital is, let's say, 6%, and a project can earn me 12%, oh, yeah, I can make more than it costs me in money to do that project. However, these two animals aren't the same. They shouldn't be, anyway, because the weighted average cost of capital is essentially just that, what all your different sources of capital are going to cost you on average. You might be able to issue bonds at 5%. You might be able to issue stock that has a cost of, let's say, 14% and all that. It's the weighted average. This is essentially what the capital markets tell you you should be making. You should pay. You'll pay. This is this other one. The required rate of return is something else. This is what the market says based upon the risk of the project, what that project must make. It's not based so much on the cost as it is just on the risk. This is the one that we really should use, although I am amazed at how many companies just use their weighted average cost of capital instead of the required rate of return. Required rate of return is the one that is the capital asset pricing model, the CAPM. Let me turn on up the lights here just for a while. We're going to need them down again to do something here. And it's really a simple formula. It just says that the required rate of return for a company, for a project, whatever, is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta, and I'm going to put a little sub P here for the project or the stock. Well, no, let me do an S for the stock. The required rate of return to that stock is going to be the risk-free rate. Everything has to deliver at least a risk-free rate or you're not going to take something on. Plus beta, sub S, times expected return to the market portfolio minus that risk-free rate. Let me explain. This thing right here, the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate, is what we call the market premium. And then you could say over risk-free. But mostly we just say the market premium. Beta is the magnifier. So if a stock is riskier than the market, say it's a 1.2, then the beta magnifies the market premium. If a stock is safe, like a 0.5, then the beta demagnifies the market premium. Let me try this. Oh, find someone I haven't bothered in a long, long time here. Who haven't I bothered? Sir, you really didn't need to go to college, you know. I mean, you do know that we don't guarantee you a job. You're putting yourself in debt beyond your wildest dreams for just a possibility of having a job. You, sir, could have gone right out of high school and worked at McDonald's for $9 an hour. Okay? That would have been a risk-free thing. You got your degree, your diploma from some high school, and you lived the dream in high school, and now it's time for you to be a boring adult who will live to about the age of 80 being really bored. Risk-free life, risk-free. However, you, sir, chose to go to college. That was a risky move. Now, let me ask you this. Are you in college to become wise, to become knowledgeable about everything, and to have the experience of awesomeness that is the growth of academic excellence?
I'm just going to get my degree.
And what will you do with that? Hopefully get a job, right? At more than what you could have made in high school. You wouldn't be here if it weren't for the fact that you hope to make more money than you would have going right out of high school. That's the expected return to the market premium. Let's say that going right out of high school, you could have made $24,000 a year. Coming out of college, you can make $60,000 a year. Your market premium is $36,000 a year. In other words, that's how much more you make by taking a risk than by taking no risk. That is that market premium. The expected value of the return to the market, which means you take a risk, minus what you would have made if you'd taken no risk. So in other words, if the expected return to the market right now is 8%, and you can get a treasury bill for 2%, then the market premium is the 6% you earn for taking a risk instead of not taking any risk at all. That's what that means. In other words, beta magnifies or demagnifies the extra reward you take for getting a risk, for taking a risk. That's all, and don't think that's some deep, deep philosophical thing. It's just how markets work. Look, if you take a risk, you're going to make more than if you take no risk. That's just the reality of it. That's this piece right here. Now, the beta, as I said, you've seen the betas of stocks. What they really are is magnifiers or demagnifiers on that risk premium. You're going to get a reward for taking the market risk over the risk-free. How much of a reward is based upon how risky you want to be. You take on a stock that has a beta of 1.5, you would expect to get 150% more than just pure market position. And then, of course, we do add in this risk-free rate again, because everything has to pay you at least a risk-free or you're not going to do it. If you can take a treasury bill that has no risk at 2%, but other investments are offering you 1%, 1.25%, you're never going to take them on. Why would you? If you can take no risk whatsoever and make more than that. So in other words, this R sub F here is nothing but the baseline kind of. So when I draw this line here with beta of a stock against the the required rate of return of that stock, two things I'm going to know. At a beta of zero, if you take no risk whatsoever, you will get the risk-free rate, not surprisingly. And if I have a beta of exactly 1.0, well, by definition, a beta of 1.0 is the return to the market portfolio. That's what beta 1, that's by definition. A beta of 1 is 100% of the market. So in other words, 100% of the market is the market. It's just like a definition. There's nothing deep about it. But here's the thing. You might remember from deep in your algebra past that it takes 2 points to define a line. Well, here's the line. This is called the security market line. The security market line. It's just a plot of what you can get, what you expect to get given the beta of a security. Now, what I'm going to tell you here should help you with your homework a little bit. I'm going to tell you some answers if you think about it. So, for example, let's look at this. Suppose that you take a stock of 0.5 beta. Well, you'd get, let's say that's stock A. Then that would be what you would expect to get, your required rate of return to stock A, right there, okay? Let's say that you took on a beta of 1.5. Well, that's a much riskier stock, and you'll get a beta up here, or rather a required return of up there, an expected return, I should say. Okay, nothing really complicated about that. It's just a line that allows you to see what you're expecting to get based upon the beta of the stock. And if you look at this equation, this is actually, do you remember that thing y equals mx plus b, the slope-intercept form of an equation? B is the y-intercept, that's the R sub F, right there. The X is the independent variable, the beta. M here, that's the slope of the line. The slope of the line will always be the expected return to the market minus the risk-free rate. It's really just a fancy way of writing a linear equation in slope-intercept form. So if I were to say, okay, holding everything else constant, what happens if the Federal Reserve raises interest rates? Well, that would mean Treasury bill rates go up, which would mean that the y-intercept goes up, but everything else but the market premium beta stays the same. So what would happen is stock A would actually get a better return than it did before. But stock B, a very risky stock that used to get this, would get a lower return here. It might have to take a little bit to let that sink in. Well, another thing, what happens if expected inflation goes up? Well, that should actually kind of make everything go up. The whole line just like that. Just let it sink in. The CAPM, in practical terms, the CAPM gives us an ability to, first of all, find a discount rate for future for cash flows so we can find the present value of future expected cash flows. It also gives us a way to price stock. And I'm actually going to blindly, I'm going to do this without knowing how badly I'll be off, try to price an actual stock using the CAPM and the growth models for stock valuation. Before I do that, however, get the math off the board here for a little bit and talk about stock. Some of this, whoops. I'll need that CAPM thing a little later here, so I'll just leave it up here. First things first. Try this. Sir, what do we call the owners of a corporation? Yes, exactly. The stockholders. The owners are the stockholders. But it's just as simple as that. Now, the stockholders are the owners. That's one of the reasons a stockholder really can't sue a corporation, because the stockholder would be suing himself or herself. You are the corporation. So, in a strange sort of way, if you have owned stocks, or if you have a pension plan or something like that that invests in stocks, railing and bitching about that company is you're actually railing and bitching about yourself, because you're part of that company. You really are, as one of the stockholders of the company. Now, the stockholders, remember, and always keep this in mind, because I almost invariably, I'm going to ask it again on the final exam. The stockholders don't get the first claim to the profits. They get the last claim. They get the residual claim. The bill, the people who have you owe bills to, and bonds and interest, those are the prior claimants. They get what's due to them first, always. Watch out for that. There's this idea, well, in bankruptcy, no, stop the bankruptcy stuff. This is every day. Whatever bills are due, a coupon payment, the wage earner's paychecks, a bill from a supplier, whatever, those come first. Whatever is due as far as bills go, those come before dividends can be issued, period. Then, in other words, the debt holders of all kinds have the prior claim to the assets. The upside, though, is that the stockholders essentially control the corporation, because the stockholders have the voting rights to the board of directors. You own 100 shares of ABC Corporation. And let's say that the board of directors has 5 positions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The board of directors, the words you hear for those, we think of CEO, COO. No, those are the executives. The board, the names you would hear are president, treasurer, secretary, member at large, outside director, whatever. Those are the ones who hire the CEO, the CFO, the COO, the CIO. You are voting for the people who hire the management. And you would have 100 votes for each of these positions, with 100 shares of stock. Now, if I have 50 shares and there's a total outstanding of 150, then you are the majority shareholder. I got nothing. All I can do is whine and bitch. But if you own 100, I own 50, and you own 75, we can form a voting block against you because you don't own the majority of the shares. However, if you can keep us split up, pit us against each other, you can control the voting anyway. I should mention here really quickly a couple things. Classified stock. Some companies have several classes of stock, like Class A and Class B. Class A and Class B, it might be, and this is just an example, the Class A stock, one vote per share, per seat. One vote for share per seat. The Class B would be super voting. It might have 100 votes per share per seat. This insider group can then control the firm. No outside group or individual would be able to overrun and change the board of directors in a class, if there's classified stock. Ford Motor Company is this way. The insiders run it. HP was that way. One that was kind of bothers me, Lyft. If you look at its IPO, it was offering Class A, and then there was this Class B stock that was registering. That was insiders who were getting their stock registered so they could sell it. That's a little bit of a bother to me. Generally speaking, okay, let me show. This one's my favorite. Sir, have you ever heard of a man named Warren Buffett?
I have.
You have, uh-huh. Warren and I are really close, you know, bros, you might say. You know, dinner at Denny's together sometimes and all that. Actually, I think he's a pompous ass, but he makes a lot more money than I do, so it's okay for him to do that. Let me, here we go. Finance. Now, the company Warren Buffett runs his empire from is Berkshire Hathaway. Now, Berkshire, if you'll look, there's a Class A and a Class B. Well, let's look at Berkshire Hathaway Class A. There's the price of the Class A stock. One share. What's that number up there? Can you read me that number?
300,000.
No, 300.
305,750.
Yeah, that's one share. So if you order a round lot of those. Now, I've got some change under the seat of my car, but I'm pretty sure it's not enough to buy one share, much less a round lot. This is super voting stock. This is the power stock. Now, if you want Berkshire B, the cheap seat stock, oh, there you go. There is your Kmart version. Okay? So, yes, you can be an owner of Berkshire Hathaway. Now, here's what really weirds me out. On any given day, there's some trading volume in this stuff. Who is buying 201 shares of that stock? I mean, I need to know because I've got this GoFundMe I've been thinking about. There's trading in this son of a thing, okay? God. Look at this. Oh, hey. It's at 305,750 right now. The target is 359,220. That's a hellacious run-up in the stock price. That would be a... Let me do that real quick. I'm just curious. What is the target? What are they saying here? They're saying 359,220 divided by 305,750 minus 1. They're saying that stock's got about, is projected to rise 17.5% over the coming year. That is pretty, that's spectacular. So you might want to think about, you know, calling your mom and dad, seeing if, you know, they could put a little extra money in your account. I don't even know how to react to that, but that is actually an extremely expensive stock, and it's a class, you know, it's a class A. Okay, sometimes it's A, sometimes it's B, but the different classes indicate that there is super majority voting, and either you're not allowed to buy it, or to buy it, you'd have to pay the price to get into the big dogs club. See, you can actually join the supermajority voting shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway, right there. That would give you a seat at a table with Warren Buffett at dinner. You know, there's this all-you-can-eat Chinese diner by the Meyer down here. You could say, hey, let's have our shareholder meeting there. They'd say, absolutely. Or IHOP. But if you own one of these sad little shares, you don't even exist to them. Not as a voting power, not really even as a human being. I hate to hurt your feelings about that, but, you know. The deal is this, though. Generally speaking, you really aren't going to have any power as a voter. You can vote. You can go to a shareholders meeting. But you own 1,000 shares? Yes.
What if like a company is family owned by a bunch of financial institutions?
How did,
is it just like one person representing the institution?
It would be their representative. It would be the representative of that hedge fund or of that investment company or that equity firm that would be the voter on behalf of the owners of the company that owned the stock. The thing of it is that you really, even if you own 1,000 shares, 10,000 shares, 50, 100,000 shares, you really don't have any power. You can vote your shares. I'll go to that shareholder meeting and I'll have my say, which actually sometimes there are special interest groups that buy stock a little bit, just so they have the right to go to the annual shareholders meeting and say something, which they can. There are some famous examples. There are special interest groups that are constantly buying stocks just so they can go and cause trouble at the shareholders meetings. And sometimes they begin to have impact. If they can gather enough steam and enough money to get a decent number of shares, they can actually, over a period of years, get the policy of a company to change. There was a group back in the 1990s that bought stock of restaurants. Specifically, they were targeting restaurants to make them go no smoking, back before smoking was considered that horrible. And they targeted Wendy's. Every year, they'd have their representative go there and speak at the shareholders meeting and stir up, you know, make everyone really uncomfortable before the vote for the officers, the directors of the company. More recently, you've seen special interest groups going after such things as investment policies of companies in green technology. You're not green enough. We're going to buy shares, and we're going to come to your shareholders meeting and bitch at you about this. Workers' rights. There's been a big movement in recent years to divest of companies that are discriminatory in their practices against women, against minorities. Practices in other countries. There's been a very large controversial movement in the past few years to get companies to divest of their stock in companies that work with Israel because of the Palestinian issue. So, and whether you agree with it or not, they do have the right to speak. They are owners. They may be minority shareholders, but under the rules of order, and the best way it was ever spoken was by Robert's Rules of Orders. The minority has the right to speak. The majority has the right to control. So we have to give the minority shareholders their due. Now, you own 100 shares of a company, madam. You could go to the shareholders meeting and you could vote your shares. You can vote them. If the meeting is in Hawaii, well, you know, it gives you an excuse to go to Hawaii. And it sounds really cool. Yes, I have to go to Hawaii to the annual shareholders meeting of this corporation. I own stock in it. I have to vote. You could do that. You probably won't. What you do instead is you're going to get, if you're a shareholder, you're going to get something in the mail. It's going to be like, well, it can be a lot of things, but it's usually like a card. That's called a proxy. A proxy is a document, essentially an agreement, giving someone else the right to vote your shares. Now, a proxy statement explains exactly who it is and why they want it. You see, I am one of the longtime directors of a corporation. Now, I like what I do, and I think the corporation is just fine. I'm happy. You, sir, are an outsider. You think that this company is crap. The directors have gotten soft. The company could do a lot better. They are hiring executives for the company that are just good old boys, and you want to shake it up. So you might come, the directors, the shareholders, might get a proxy statement from me. Let me vote your shares. I'll vote for myself. You send him a countering proxy saying, give me your shares, and I'll kick that son of a bitch out and put my team in there. In other words, you're getting yourself, you might be moving for a hostile takeover. What you could be doing is you're buying up shares so that you have direct vote. And then, without triggering too much interest in what you're doing, because you're going to have to tell the SEC that you're taking a position in the company. Over 5%. Then, once you're near that trigger, then you start sending out the proxies to get enough extra votes to have the voting power to kick out the existing board of directors. Okay? Now, that's good enough right there. But you're not doing it just so you can sit on a board of directors. Let's say you are going to get control of the board of directors. And then you are going to force this company to be taken over by your company. So you could be actually involved in a hostile takeover. You're going to get enough shares so that you can kick out the people who would fight you. And then you have smooth sailing to get my company and all of its assets and everything else about it and merge it into your company in a takeover. There are all kinds of takeovers. You are a predator, a black knight. You're trying to come in. You want to take my corporation away from me and put it into yours. So what you're going to do is you're going to do a tender offer for my shares. Let's say that right now the price per share is $20 per share, common. What you might do is you might make a tender offer for $21 per share. Shareholders are going to look at that and say, hell, I can't sell my stock on the open market for 20, so I'm going to, sure, I'll sell it to you for 21. Okay? So suddenly you start getting shares. that way, gathering position. Are you dead? No. There are a couple of things you can do. First of all, there are the two that come to mind very quickly are the White Knight and the poison pills. The White Knight would be another corporation that is willing to work with me for an agreement for director positions and work together. And then they would come in and they would say, we are going to counter tender at 23 per share, which knocks you out, forces you to go above that. You want this? You're going to have to pay candy. Okay, and the White Knight is going to defend my position as one of the existing directors against the hostile takeover by the Black Knight. Another thing that can happen is poison pills. I'm not going to just sit there and let you do something stupid, okay, to me. I'm not going to just sit here, well, looks like that's it for me. No, what I probably would do if I want to keep, I might work with a White Knight, but what I might also do is just make my corporation so it's nasty. I might just take on a whole pile of new debt, put the risk of this corporation through the roof, so that when you take me over, you have to take over my debt too, and that's a big fish for a small killer whale to swallow. Okay, I can do that. I can do all kinds of golden parachute for my executives and for me. Well, if we're kicked out of the corporation, we're each given $50 million, and then you end up, if you buy the corporation, you buy the contracts for the golden parachute. There are all kinds of poison pills out there that you can use. Deploying them is controversial. You're also hurting yourself when you do these. If I put poison pills into my company to protect it from him, I'm hurting that debt. Well, if he doesn't take me, I'm stuck with that debt. Those golden parachutes, yeah, once I put those in place, just watch those guys that I've given them to say, okay, we can give those up now. You see, poison pills are poison to everyone. You just want to make sure they're more poison to the Black Knight than to anyone else, than to the company itself. These are different methods of the hostile and the counter to the hostile. And this is the world that I was in. This was one of the things I did. M&As were, I was one of the M&As, mergers and acquisitions. And they happen all the time. Right now, we're constantly scouring. Look what's going to happen here. If there is going to be a proxy fight for control of a corporation, you're probably going to see that price of that target start to go up as the knights come after each other. Now, by the way, another thing a White Knight can do, if you, madam, are a White Knight, you might not come to my defense. You might go after him. Because as he starts driving up that price, he's weakening his corporation. Because the present value of future expected cash flows to his company is going to go down because he's paying so damn much for this stock to do this deal. So you can just start going after him. As he chases me, he's wearing himself down, and you can hit him. Know this, that in a hostile takeover, the target price ends up being much higher than it would have been otherwise. And the Black Knight's stock price actually goes down. So that's your play on my behalf to take him over. We might even have a deal. Once you've taken him, we chop that thing up, send him off to work at McDonald's, and we take the assets and liquidate them, and we've had a good day. As a matter of fact, there are old rumors about forgive me, this is sexist terminology. It was called the damsel in distress ploy. A company would give the appearance of having weakness, dissent in its ranks among the directors, shareholder issues, and that would give some predators the incentive to start circling and coming after us. And then we would have already staged something with a White Knight so that once they went on the attack, they were coming at us, and the White Knights were coming at them from the background to take them over while I said, well, I don't know what to do. They're coming after me, and they're going to eat me. And I know very well that you're my White Knight. You're coming to eat them because they're blindsided because they're all focused on the attack on me, not paying attention to the White Knights who are going after them because they've weakened themselves coming after me. all kinds of weird, cool stuff. So if you're into that kind of thing, it's fun, but it's also kind of dangerous because people get really upset when you take over the corporations they started 50 years ago and you kick them out. But there's that. And, anyway. That's some of that background. Now, when a company already has stock outstanding and it issues more stock in a second public offering, usually the existing shareholders will have preemptive rights. So in other words, the existing shareholders would have the first right to buy stock in the new offering so that their position is not watered down. Like if you own 100 shares in a 1,000 share corporation, you're a 10% owner. If I decide I want to issue 500 more shares, your position becomes not 100 of 1,000, it becomes 100 of 1,500. So generally speaking, you're going to have the right to buy in front of everyone else to keep your position at exactly what it was before. You would have the right to buy 50 shares before the public could get it.
So I stay at 10%?
Exactly, exactly. Do shareholders do this? Actually, not really, not often. I mean, you really don't care about your control position, you know, but some do. And so the preemptive rights is what they call. There's that. I've always wanted to do a course here, mergers, acquisitions, and hostile takeovers. I guarantee you that is an interesting class. That would be so cool, but no, we don't get into that kind of stuff here.
Okay. That's cool.
Now, back to a little math. Over a very long period of time, a company should have a current price that's the present value of its future expected cash flows to the shareholders. We call that free cash flow to equity, FCFE. Now, you take my 242 course or even my 341 course, and I'll show you free cash flow to equity, how you estimate it. It's not hard. And as a matter of fact, I show you here how you get the free cash flow. You know, the free cash flow technically it's not, but net income plus the depreciation added back in minus the capital expenditures for the year minus the change in net working capital from what the last year to this year. And I mean, if I did this on a projected basis out many, many years and then took the present value of those, that should be the market cap of the corporation. And then you divide it by the number of shares outstanding, that should be the price. And we do that in some classes. Really, at the end of the day, this is the only way you can do it if it's a company that is unstable, doesn't pay a dividend, and all of that. We have to do it that way. I've already mentioned this, I'll say it again. Oftentimes, the delegations that I am teaching from West Africa and the Caribbean and Central America, they are here as government officials because they want to put government investment into private companies. And they want to know how to figure out whether this is a worthwhile investment or not. I have to teach them just this. Let's look at a private company. Let's look at its. Let's project its free cash flows out. Let's say on a 5-year holding period or a 10-year holding period, and let's see if what they want you to invest in them, let's say $50 million, is worth $50 million or more. If it is, we say yes. Take the present value of those free cash flows out 5 years. which would be the holding holding period, and let's see if it's worth it to put $50 million in. You're a government, so you have to watch out for the interests of the people of the country. If this is profitable for the people, yes. And it will also grow a private company that will then employ more people and create economic opportunities within the nation and all that. Oftentimes, when we do it, they bring me numbers, and I look at the, we go through it. Real private private companies they're thinking of investing in, very often they're not worth the investment. But technically, I mean, the free cash flow to equity, the present value of those future expected cash flows should be, divided by the number of shares outstanding, should be the price of the stock. That is a lot like work, but I mean, with Excel, it looks scary at first, but once you've got Excel involved, then it becomes really, I mean, just easy stuff. You take 341 or 242 from me, and I'll show you how to punch the numbers in, and then just get the string of the free cash flows out, and then we just take the present value of them and bring them back. So that is our, how should I say, our most complicated, comprehensive method. We could use this on any company, private or public, to get the price per share of the stock. However, short of that, we've got some nice things we can do if there is something less than just primitive about the company. Preferred stock, for example. Preferred stock has a constant dividend forever. Preferred stock has a constant dividend forever. It says it right on the certificate. They say what the par value of the stock is, and they tell you what the percent coupon is on it, a percent dividend is on it. So you could have CDV 1.5% cumulative preferred par value $40 per share. That tells you everything you need to know. This means that you will get a dividend payment forever of 1.5% times $40. Which would be 60 cents. Every year, forever, and ever, and ever. Now, see that cumulative part? That means that if it's cumulative preferred, if the company can't pay you the dividend that some year, it has to accumulate, and they have to pay it to you the next year. If they can't pay it to you the next year, then they have to pay you both of them the year after that. And they can't pay a common dividend until they've caught up with all of their preferred dividends. This is why preferred, which isn't that popular, companies aren't issuing it like they used to. This is why preferred is actually a great fixed income investment for retired people. I mean, yeah, bonds are because they pay those coupons every year for, but I mean, with preferred, you never have to worry about reinvesting the money. Now, interestingly enough, if you took an infinite stream of these payments, forever, and you took the present value of it, it's actually not an infinite number. The price would be that constant dividend divided by the discount rate the market was applying. I erased my cap M. Preferred stock will not move around a lot, but it actually, the present value is that simple formula right there. Taking it one step further, if it's a common stock, that has a constant growth of the dividend. If it's a common stock, with constant growth of the dividend, and we'll call that growth rate G. Then the formula isn't much worse. In other words, this would have to be a stable corporation. Its dividend isn't just bonk, 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 bonk. It's set on a path. The price of that kind of stock would be the dividend one period out. You have to go one period out. So if I told you the dividend is a dollar and the growth rate is 5%, you'd have to put $1.05 in there. Don't forget. Don't let me bluff you. If I say the current dividend is, then you grow it one period. If I say the next dividend will be, then you've got your D1. And then you divide that by the CAPM required rate of return minus the growth rate. Now, we can use this even on companies that are not quite stable on their dividend. You see, companies actually aim eventually to have a constant growth rate of the dividend. But for a few years, you might have a company like this one. It might, let's say, pay 40 cents 1 year, then 48 cents, and then 50 cents. But then, from there on, it stabilizes the growth to, let's say, 4%. This isn't much worse. Because what you're going to do with a company like this, let's say that the case of S is 7%. In a case like this, what you would do is you would say, I'm going to take the present value of 40 cents discounted back 1 year. I'm going to take the present value of 48 cents discounted back 2 years. I'm going to take the present value. Watch this. I'm going to do it a little easier. You see here at year three, once I'm at year four, I can use the constant growth rate model to find the present value of all of these back to year three by that dividend model right there. So in other words, here at year three, we have this 50 cents, and then we have the present value of 50 cents grown one more period at 4% divided by 0.07 minus 0.04. That would be the present value of all of the dividends forever after that. But it would be the present value at year three. It's 1 year before. I add that to 50 cents, and then I take that present value all the way back the rest of the way. And if I were to do that, the first thing that I would do is I would take that calculator, and I'd say, okay, 40 cents, let me do this part first. 0.5 times 1.04 divided by 0.03, $17.33. So this is $17.33 is the present value of the rest of the dividends forever. I would add that to the 50 cents I will get in year three to get $17.83. And then I would take that back, 0.48 times 1 plus 0.07 to the negative third power, and I get my final answer. Let me get that. Let's see if I can get that real fast here.
0.4 times 1.07 to the negative 1
plus 0.48
times 1.07 to the negative second
plus $17.83. Wait, I said 0.48 here. That's not. That's $17.83. I apologize. I'm trying to work too fast here.
Plus $17.83 times 1.07 to the negative third power. Stock price should be about $15.35.
Right now.
That would be if the company has some instability in its dividends. But then you say, well, okay, what if we have a company that is stable, it's already gotten to a mature phase where its dividends are staying about the same year over year? Fair enough, I'm actually going to try to price an actual real stock that is a mature corporation with a stable growth rate of the dividend. And what I'll try to do here is I'm going to do Kellogg. It's at 56.66 right now. I'll use a 0.7 for the cap M. The risk-free rate, I'm going to use about a 7-year. You could use a real short one or maybe a 7-year. Looks like about 2.42. So for the purposes of the cap M, to do this trick and use just the plain old stable dividend growth model, I'm going to need the CAPM information, the R sub F, which I'm going to take as 2.42%. The beta for Kellogg is 7.70. The growth rate of the dividend. Now, how in the hell am I going to find that? It's actually, if it's an old corporation, I'm going to go to the SEC, and I'm going to try... Whoops. Kellogg just issued its 10K. If I look at its interactive financial data, there's its dividends right there. Let's see if those are fairly stable. 2.12, whoops, bring my calculator back up. 2.12 divided by 2.04 minus 1 is a growth rate of about 3.9%. 2.20 divided by 2.12 minus 1 should be around 3.8%. So it is actually stable. To the penny, that's actually a growth rate that is very stable at about 3.8%. I can get the discount rate and then use that dividend model to see the price. The only thing I'm missing is what the expected return to the market portfolio is right now. In other words, what are the investors thinking the market is going to deliver over the next year? Now, what I went to some data vet fields. I didn't use my own. Mine's a little lower than what the current is for a lot of analysts and experts. Right now, it looks like the expected return to the market portfolio, most analysts are saying, is about 10.15%. Over the next year, a market portfolio
They're expected to be earning about 10.15%. So now I can apply the CAPM. The discount rate for Kellogg would be 2.24% plus 0.70 times 10.15% minus 2.42%. Now, let me work that out. God, I hope I'm at least a little bit close. 2.42 plus 0.7 times, open parenthesis, 10.15 minus 2.42, close the parentheses, 7.83. That's the discount rate for Kellogg's, for Kellogg. If this is correct, all of my data, the price of Kellogg should be the dividend it just paid, grown one period at 3.8%, over 7.07, got to use the decimal, 0.0783 minus the growth rate, minus G, 0.038. Okay, let's see what they, okay, $2.20, so next year's dividend, D1 would be times 1.038. 2.2836 divided by open parenthesis 0.0783 minus 0.038. Watch, the whole model looks terrible. Close the parenthesis. Holy. What was the price of the stock? Well, spank me, Jesus. Almost dead on to the money. Look at that. But that only works only for stable companies like that. That's all I have for you. Go home.